Well, Matt, what?
I don't know. This is the first episode of the historical document, the Closet Trekkie podcast. Episode one, even though technically I think we did two like a decade ago.
Was it even known as a podcast then?
Yeah. It was, they were all the rage.
What did we do?
It was kind of more like a radio show, and we like played songs and then talked about them.
Where was that posted?
It was on our website.
Oh yeah.
For a while. And, I don't have any of those anymore. I don't know what happened to them.
Well, this one will be the official document.
This is yes. I haven't looked into how to get a podcast notarized yet. I don't know if it's possible, but I'm going to try.
We're going to try real hard. To the Smithsonian.
A poor man's copyright is send it to yourself in the mail and don't open it. Stands up in court of law.
Closet Trekkie podcast episode 0/episode 1.
001. In line with the label release numbers.
Yeah, we're giving ourselves a wide berth here in case this thing goes on for a while. So episode 001. This one we're going to call Working at an Indie Record Store. But really, if we need to, I think, talk about, you know, how the genesis of the label. But the most recent iteration of Closet Trekkie is a website. It's a fully functioning website, updated maybe every 2 years.
And right now
it serves as a music blog / short story prose outlet.
Yeah.
/ digital EP possible releases.
All true.
So that's been its recent form in the last 4 or 5 years. Before that, it was dead for a couple of years.
There's always been a website.
There was always been a website. I remember the one that used to have the spinning record on the top, which was probably my favorite website ever.
There was a spinning record on the top?
Yeah, and at the very top left, there was like this like spinning old school looking record, and it would consistently spin as like
it spun. It actually spun.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. So after the kind of, it was kind of dead. Before that, it was a Buddyhead ripoff music site for about 6 months.
Yeah, until we realized that that wasn't who we wanted to be.
Well, at the time, we had actual active artists on the label, and what we also realized was if people hated the website, they may hate the bands that were associated.
It is a problem. Yeah, it's not. So it's not a not good marketing.
Yeah, we didn't realize it until after the fact. The website, you know, unique users did see its peak though at that time, and basically we were trying to be provocative and post articles about what we hated or what we thought was lame in the music scene at the time. But before that, it was a fully functioning independent record label with multiple artists on the roster who toured, and we would press hard copies of releases, mostly vinyl, some CDs.
Yep. Book tours.
Book tours. Promote. At South By. Yeah.
Yeah.
CMJ. All that stuff. And that was 2004 to 2012 probably, or 11. In some way, shape, or form, it was in that.
It was the peak.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years of that. And then what we're talking about today is how did that even happen? And I think for that, how did the record label start? Like, how do you start a indie record label? What does that look like? Does that even happen these days? I don't even know if that even exists anymore.
Yeah, but to tell the story, you have to go back to the beginning.
You have to go back to the beginning. So Paul and I grew up. Well, when did you move to Danbury, Connecticut?
1998.
Okay, so you were 14.
Yeah. Wow. Impressed. That's good math.
And you were, well, I don't know if you were 14 or 15. I forget your exact.
I'm pretty sure I was 14. Yeah. I think you were 13.
I was 13. Lived in Danbury, Connecticut. So it's right in the border of New York. And me and Paul met and became friends. And as one does at 16, you start to look for a job. Mm-hmm. And there was one giant mall in Danbury and basically served all of Western Connecticut. This one mall, everyone west of Hartford came to this mall.
Right.
And it was in our town. So your first job was where? Yep.
I forget. I worked at Macy's. I worked in the kids department. I would hang
in the mall. Yeah.
I would hang, like, I would just restore order to chaos after like a Memorial Day weekend. And that was at cash register, staring down a line of annoyed, stressed out, tired people, like a line out the door waiting to buy, you know, like
sweaters for their kid,
sweaters, Pokemon t-shirts, very small suits, that cost as much as an adult suit. Wait, what?
So Macy's is one of those big stores that was at the end of the mall, obviously, an anchor tenant. So was that the kind of thing where you parked your car and you walked into Macy's and you were like, well, may as well apply here. It's the first place I walked into.
No. So my mom worked there first.
Oh, yeah.
And she knew the manager. And
I can get you in.
Yeah. We can make this happen right now. So it's kind of the story of my life at that time is like whatever was the easiest. I guess I didn't want to have to stress out too much. So I was like, yeah, that's, you know, I'm a shoo-in. I'll take it.
Do you remember what your starting wage was, hourly?
Oh, man, I think it was like $6.49 an hour.
That's, I think $6.50 was the minimum wage at the time.
So I made a penny under. It was pretty much, yeah. I was excited to get like a $75 paycheck.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I drove my grandpa's old Nissan Sentra, 1991 white, missing front left hubcap.
You can spot it out of in a crowd.
Yeah. It really stood out. That was why I liked it.
Sir, that's actually my Sentra.
So yeah, I did. We did get in the wrong one time. it's a Sentra thing.
So yes, so we had friends that my sister worked at the Banana Republic in there. We had a friend that worked at J. Crew, a buddy that worked at the Saturday Matinee, which was the old VHS DVD store. I mean, everyone just worked in the mall. Mm-hmm. And same thing for me. I turned 16. I got a job at the Gap. First job, you know, you just show up and you say, can I apply? It's just a rotating cast of people that quit probably three at a time every day. So there's always a job opening to fold clothes and get a job. It's probably, yeah, June or July, because I turned 16 in May or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I got $7 an hour. I don't want to make you feel bad.
Seven. You always made more than me.
I guess they like what they saw. Yeah. And it was the first time, it was kind of the first time in your life that you have to know your social security number. Cause it's like you would log in, you know, on the timesheet. So and I was like, what's my social security number? I don't know what it is. I used to have to write it in my wallet and like carry it with me. Cause I didn't know what it was.
Right.
I think after 6 months I remembered it. But so I worked there and this is all at the same time as we're like really, I think, trying to figure out like what type of music we like. So, you know, we're 15, 16, you know, before that we were probably exclusively into Weezer. And
yeah.
This is Weezer. Pre-Green album.
Pre-Green album Weezer. And then like all the alt rock or whatever was on Radio 104.
Yeah.
At the
Radio
time.
104. 104.1 was the, mm-hmm. I think it was out of New Haven or something, and it served Danbury, the modern rock station alternative.
Yep.
They always had like the wacky morning guys. It was Dee Snider from Twisted Sister, and then
that's
some
right.
guy named like, you know, Mud Chop or Sponge. I don't really know.
Hammock.
Yeah,
something. Yeah.
And yeah, you'd look for something, you know, there that spoke to you because it was still the era of 56K modem, nothing streaming. If you wanted to listen to a clip, maybe on CD Now or CD Baby or Amazon, it was 30-second clips of songs. So how did you find, you know, how did you find new bands? I mean, the very first CD I remember buying from Amazon was Enema of the State. So that was, what, 99?
So from Amazon?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I bought it from Amazon. I asked, you know, if I could use my dad's credit card, and I said, I paid him the $20 in cash. I just bought
$20?
It. $20? You know, I just bought it. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So,
that was
so
the first CD I bought from Amazon.
So it wasn't like Columbia House or BMG Music Club or something like that.
Well, I did that, and so I had, you know, the starter pack, you know, Seal. That's the Batman Forever
Boys to Men.
Yeah, whatever was just handed to you in Columbia House.
Yeah.
Because you had no choice but to take it. But I never really liked any of that stuff. Like, I mean, I remember the Batman Forever soundtrack. It had an Offspring song. And that was cool because it was fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, what? I wonder what this stuff is. I didn't really know what it was. I didn't have an older brother or anyone to teach me about music. I had a cousin in Houston, but it's like, what were you going to do? Like, you couldn't text back then. So I really had no one to tell me what was going on. So me and you were trying to figure it out together. So we definitely Blink-182 was probably the first time you were like, what is this? Like, that is... seems like it's off the run. It seems like it's a little bit faster than anything else, but of course it's popular. Start looking through the liner notes, start looking at the thank yous, and oh, who's Unwritten Law and Dancehall Crashers and NoFX and this kind of stuff. So then you start looking, finding CDs that way, I guess, or records that way. And at the time, you go to the Wall, which was the big music store in the mall. And it was $20 for a CD, and you'd look at it, and you basically had to pick one CD a month that you could afford, so you better get it right. So we went to the Wall, and I think you and I both realized early on also that you could buy the Punk-O-Rama or Fat Music for Fat People discs, and you'd get like 20 songs for $3.99.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get these drive-through samplers or Epitaph samplers or...
Punk-O-Rama.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, you know, from the Blink ones, we started, I guess, finding out these other names, and you look at the back of a Punk-O-Rama CD and you're like, hey, there's NoFX, there's Pennywise or something. I guess I better buy this. And then inevitably there's like only two or three songs you like on those things. And then you realize there's gotta be a better way, because some of these bands you couldn't find at the Wall, or you couldn't find at Circuit City or something, wherever you were buying CDs. You're like, where do I get these CDs? And I don't know how we stumbled across Volt. I don't remember the first time I went in there. Do you?
The first time? I don't.
The very first time.
I don't think I remember the very first. Well, I do. I remember before, I think it was before we worked there. Did we pre-order the Green Album? Weezer's the Green Album there?
Yeah, that might.
Was that the first time? No.
That would have been March or April of 2001.
So early on. Yeah.
I do remember going to Funkoland, which was a video game store next door to it, and looking through to the other, to Volt, which was next door, and seeing all these crazy posters on the wall and these things hanging. And I was like, I'm afraid to go in there. I was like 15. I'm like, I don't want to get made fun of. I don't know what that is.
I don't want my parents to be mad.
Yeah. I don't want my parents to be like, what is that store? Yep. It smells like, you know, it smells like a third rate Hot Topic or something. You know?
Third rate.
And,
like, so your parents knew what that smelled like.
Well, Hot Topic you could smell like from a couple blocks away. It seemed like in the mall back in the day.
Oh, like the incense and stuff.
Yeah. And so I think probably the first time I saw it was through Funkoland when we were looking for video games and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened was, so I'm working at Gap and I have a car, Volvo, hand-me-down 740, 80, I think it's an 89. And I was probably just driving home and I saw this like sign that said Volt Records. And I was looking for Kid Dynamite. I think I remember this specifically, because what happened was I was on an Amazon rabbit hole. So basically I had gone from like a Blink-182 song to, you know, then the next artist that it takes you to. And if you like that artist, you might like this artist. And if you like that artist, you might like this artist, et cetera, et cetera. And somehow I got to Kid Dynamite. And Shorter, Faster, Louder came out in 2000. So it was, they had already broken up. And I put on the first track, which is Pits and Poison Apples. It's 30 seconds long. And I couldn't believe what I heard, how it was fast and aggressive. But then in the middle of it, out of nowhere, it's catchier than any Blink-182 song. And I was like, what in the world is this? I have to get this. I have to get this CD. And I thought, well, maybe this place will have it. And I walked in and they had it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. And the guy at the counter was like, hey, if you sign up for a club, all we need is your phone number. If you buy 10 CDs or 11 CDs, you get the 12th one free. I was like, this is great. This is awesome. So sign me up. So what basically happened at that point was after every shift at Gap, I would just drive over there and buy something. And I think I remember also getting, I think Bane, Give Blood, that Saves the Day, Stay What You Are album came out around that time. What was happening, I didn't realize it, was the 12, 11 CDs that you were buying was basically like a tracking cool list, apparently. to some nameless, you know, person at Volt that was, you know, seeing what you were buying and if it was up to their standard.
Yeah, man in a cloak in a dark corner.
Yeah. And there was enough, I guess, there that this was a true story. I don't know how this happened, but basically it's November now and I work Black Friday at Gap. So it's like the busiest shopping day of the year. Mm-hmm. I get in there like at 6 a.m. and leave like at midnight. And I was working the cash register at the time and I just like hated it. And the next day, like after that next shift, the day after Black Friday, I get off earlier and I go to Volt and I go up to the counter and Gene, who was the owner, says, hey, would you want to work here?
Just out of nowhere. So you didn't ask?
Yeah. I didn't ask. I was buying some, I'm trying to think what I might have been buying. I don't know, like Hope Conspiracy, Cold Blue or something at the time. And I put it on there. I think it was going to be my free one actually. And so like I was up there for longer than normal. So he was finding my name and number and what I was going to get towards.
Redeeming.
Yeah. And he says, do you want to work here? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, don't work here? He's like, we need someone, you know, during the holiday rush that's about to start, but also then another of our workers is going back to college. So there's going to need to be someone that can work longer. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah. I was like,
great.
Yeah. He's like, I can only pay you $650. So I was like, well, it's a pay cut. I didn't give it 2 weeks notice or anything.
You didn't. The next day. You're just like, I'm done.
So basically I can never work at Gap again.
Right.
Or their affiliates, Old Navy and Banana Republic.
Oh, you burned a bridge, man. Yeah, gonna regret that.
Lesson learned. So one man quit and within like a day I was working at Volt and like I told my parents, you know, which you got, I guess you have to get approval for. And I was like, hey, I got a job at a record store. And I told them like all my money is going towards CDs anyway, so I may as well work at a place where I get a discount. And all my dad was like, what did they pay you? I'm like, less than what I was making before. He's like, nice job.
Great job. Chip off the old block.
Yeah, way to go. But I took it, and that was basically right before like the Christmas or holiday season of 2001. And at the time, Emily worked there, so there's another colleague of ours, colleague worker,
mm-hmm. fellow employee,
and she was into basically the same stuff we were into. her favorite band was Thursday at the time, because Full Collapse had just come out. Mm-hmm. And then there was, I forget his name, who was really into indie rap, which I had no idea even existed. I forget his name, but he basically educated us on like Def Jux and every like Atmosphere when he was just starting out, and all these things that I had no idea existed. And at first was dismissive of, but then you kind of open your eyes. You're like, there's all these other worlds that I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And if I just, you know, I dismiss them, then I'm being closed-minded, and it's, I'm probably shutting myself off to something really cool.
Yeah.
So that's how I got there. But I want to hear how you, what you remember between that point to like when you, I forget when you started working at Hole.
Yeah. You're going to have to fill in a lot of blanks for me, I think. but I, you know, basically it's a similar story. I moved from Northern Connecticut with my family to Danbury because my dad got a job in Norwalk. So it was, you know, it was going to save him like a two hour commute or something. So we moved to Danbury, and I remember like meeting you for the first time, and like, we had like these like similar sort of alternative, like, you know, like just alternative music was just kind of this like, to me,
vague idea.
What?
Like a vague idea that we both liked.
Yeah, like it was just like, yeah, we have the sense, because before, you know, the internet was hard back then. Like search engines were just kind of like still terrible, and most things on the internet were still kind of word of mouth, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So there's like a lot
where
that
you
was,
go to find stuff. We didn't know.
Yeah, we didn't know like we didn't know that there was like that subcultures were a thing, or you know, you're influenced by your peers or your older siblings. And my sister and her friends, my sister's like 14 years older than me. You know, she in the late 80s and 90s, like was like a big new wave and alternative rock fan, indie rock fan. And so it was really through her and her friends that like I found out about Weezer, and to me, Weezer was just like this, you know, like, it's just like, it's like loud and it's kind of hard, but also super catchy. And it's not like my parents, you know, like it's not
you
like the,
yeah,
them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was benign enough where no one would raise any eyes and or you know, raise any eyebrows, and like the lyrics were just compelling, and the you know, at the time I was probably too young to really appreciate like songwriting, mm-hmm, and production and all this stuff. It just, you know, so I was really into Weezer and like U2 and at one point like Beastie Boys.
I remember that's the first time that we talked, I think. Yeah. It was 98 and Hello Nasty had just came out.
Yep.
And I was, yeah, obsessed with that album.
Yeah. So I went through the usual like BMG, Columbia House, and just like got, you know, whatever I could think of that was kind of like that, like Weezer. Because the first CD I ever bought, I think it was like 96, was Weezer's The Blue, mm-hmm, album. Before that, the first tape that I bought was Pocket Full of Kryptonite Spin Doctors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which was like alternative, you know, pop, basically. And what it all boils down to at the end of the day is like you really just like catchy pop music. But you have you don't want to.
Admit it.
Yeah, it's sort of the same. It's really the same old story, like over and over again. Just like whatever is of niche interest, you know, eventually pops out into the mainstream or semi-mainstream. But anyway, it was that was kind of my world. My number one interest was music. And when I moved to Danbury, there was a lot more access to the same record stores that you're talking to. I remember I knew I was interested in working at the Wall, and I went and I actually applied there, and our friend Dennis was working there at the time. And so he knew the manager. Oh,
I didn't know you worked there. I guess I knew that. I just totally blocked it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I knew I was interested in working at a music store and had this guy that we knew that,
he couldn't get you in like mom got you in at Macy's though.
No, he's just not like that.
Strength.
You know, it wasn't like a blood relation thing, right? You know, at Macy's, you know, blood is thicker than water. That's their company motto. I was really surprised that they're having such financial issues now. Anyway, the manager led
me
in.
They're just giving jobs out to anyone back in the day. No wonder they're in trouble.
He, you know, I fill out an application, manager calls me back, brings me in to the back room, and they have one of those like phone personality tests, right? So you pick up the phone and there's like this pre-recorded voice that asks you questions like, have you ever talked behind your manager's back? Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. Have you ever stolen anything for your employer? Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. And really, like, I think that the goal of the test is really just to find out how, like, socially adept you are. Because, but also, like, me being just, like, this sort of innocent, happy-go-lucky, like, really just always wanting to tell the truth, sort of just, like...
sure, I've stolen.
Yeah, it's just, like... But the thing was, is, like, I was just, like, extremely honest. So, like, yeah, I've talked bad about my manager behind their back. Like stuff like that. So I go through this test. I'm totally sweating the whole way. So I hang up the phone. The manager says, okay, great. So he calls, he dials the number to find out the results. And he's like listening. And he like nods his head. He hangs up the phone. He looks at me. He says, well, you failed.
In fact, you and your children can never work. Can never work.
Right. Here. Right. In fact, I'm calling security right now. Clearly
you're
insane.
Gone. Get him out of here.
And I was kind of bummed about that because Macy's is the same deal. You're folding clothes and it's even worse than the Gap because it's, you know, obviously an older store and not cool and smells bad and it's, you know, it's a,
boss.
Yeah, exactly. A universe of just like plastic hangers and, aging parents and kids that keep getting younger, louder and louder, and eventually like it will crush your soul until you're like the random like 70-year-old guy that you work with there who has worked there for 20 years and eventually you start having sort of these sort of like morbid daydreams about turning into that person and just like giving up and saying, well, I could just work here for the rest of my life and it wouldn't be so bad.
Well, I think it's either they stay there or they end back up there later and they make the round trip. So either you were going to stay there forever or you would just end up back there after you cycle through other jobs anyway. It's like, well, Macy's will always take me.
Right. So it was, I think that was 2001, and around that time I was just starting college, and I was a high enough of a performer in my communications media arts, which was basically like the major that was closest to film studies at Western Connecticut State University. We used to call it WestCon. Acronym.
Still call it.
Yeah. Do they really?
Yeah.
Acronym WCSU. And so the media
shout out.
That's right. Yeah. So they had, it was the closest thing they had. So it included like video production and radio production. So I got a job at the, I can't remember when this was happening now. I can't remember if I worked at Volt first
I think so. I didn't think you got the radio job till after I had moved.
Oh, you might be right. Yeah. So anyway, so so it was around that time that you got the job there, and of course I started. This is my memory. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I started coming in there like every chance I got because also all of my
you
money.
You just hang out.
Yeah, I would just go there and hang out. And Gene, you know, he was like, say what you will about, you know, our old boss. He was pretty cool, laid back. And
shout out Gene.
I'm sure
he'll be listening. So
I'm sure. Yeah. He's going to be first in line. Yeah. So I think like the first thing that I did, and I don't know that I actually did it for money, was, I'm pretty sure it was before I actually worked there as an employee, but, I think Gene had mentioned to you that that he needed a website, like a new website.
Mm.
And, I had been building websites because, basically it was around that time that, was it around that time? Was that when we started Closet? No, I had already been experimenting with websites and like really interested in just like making them and like kind of like sort of like my first foray into like digital design. And of course, like digital design at that time was just like, if you can put a box on a screen and change the colors, like that's cutting edge, man. And I figured out how to make animated GIFs. And yes, I do pronounce it with a hard G. Always have.
Because don't leave anything in the comments. We don't want to hear it.
I don't want to hear it. No, don't at me. It's never been, you know, I'm a student of the English language. And as far as I could tell, like we don't really have soft G's when you start, unless you're pronouncing
unless
your
name,
Gene. Unless your name is Gene or Jeff with a G. It's not the
we should refer to Gene as, I guess, Gene now.
Gene. It's not called the Dream album. It's called the Green album.
We'll get back to the Green album.
We'll get back to that.
That's a three part episode.
And so we have a whole series planned on that. So mini series. It's a separate podcast, actually. It's similar to Serial. Anyway, so I think that was kind of the first thing I did. And that's where my memory gets hazy. I don't remember. I remember going in to Volt one time and talking to Jay. I think his name was Jay, who was like a super Weezer pop, power pop, like indie rock guy. You remember Jay?
I don't remember him.
Yeah.
Well, no, there was Jay or was James or something. Right. So I forget, but right around the time I joined, there was the quintessential emo kid. He lived in, Newtown, mm-hmm. This town over, and he actually had the star tattoos on his wrists, like the real deal, as you did back then. And I think he was wearing a Hot Rod Circuit shirt the first day I started, and he actually quote unquote trained me. Shout out Hot Rod Circuit, because mm-hmm. they were formerly from Danbury in Newtown area. Mm-hmm. And I was basically taking his job, but he didn't know it, because basically Gene's like, I need to fire this kid because he doesn't show up and he's terrible and doesn't look at people in the eyes and messes up on the transactions all the time. And so I started day one and he trained me. And then apparently like the next day Gene told him he was fired, but he didn't understand like what it was actually happening. And so he said, like, does that mean I need to come in the next day? And he's like, no, effective immediately. That means you're fired. It means you don't have a job here anymore. And he was just a nice guy. But was Jay who went, is Jay the guy who ended up doing a lot of art stuff also?
Yeah. He did
Jay
some
Hinkle
of...
or he, yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. You got it.
But when did he, I don't remember when he started, to be honest.
Well, he's before us and he. I think he left right around the time we started for college. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was, so basically they needed two people. They needed the replacement for James, I think, who lived in Newtown, Hot Rod Circuit, and then Jay, who was leaving anyway to go back to college. So I started and I worked through that holiday season. And I think it was maybe 4 or 6 months after I started. So, you know, in the spring of 2002, Gene, at that point, like, you basically were in every day anyway. So I think he was like, should I just pay this kid to work here? And yeah, you started, and I think we had alternating days. I think he knew smart enough to never put us on the same day, because we would just really not ever work. So right. I think we alternated.
You and I, you mean?
I think like I worked the double Saturday shift and maybe a Monday and a Wednesday. And maybe, what did you work? Tuesday, Friday, and I don't even know. Something like that. Sunday. I don't really know.
And it was annoying because we couldn't hang out.
Yeah. It went from like the greatest thing ever. Like we both got a job at Volt and we're going to hang out. And basically it ended up, we would just go there on our days off to hang out.
Right. So it didn't really matter because we were going to be there anyway, no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
It was basically exactly like Pretty in Pink or High Fidelity. It's just like, you're there. You just start showing up every day. Right.
Yeah. It's like, these guys started showing up and they show up every day now,
right?
Like whether I pay them or not. And what was funny is that I don't think deserved, quote unquote, to have a job there. And according to our mutual older friend, Dennis, I really didn't deserve to have, deserve to have that job. But I remember meeting him and we were talking and I had never met him before. I think you had met him, but I don't know how, you know, the topic of music comes up and he's like, what kind of music do you like? And I was telling him that I really liked that new Bane album, and he couldn't, like, his eyes like opened up. He's like, I can't. He's like, what? You like the new Bane album? You like Bane? I was like, yeah, yeah. I was like, they're good. And I like the new Strike Anywhere album. And he just like was flipping out. Like, couldn't believe that, like, you know, someone random that he had just met was into something. And he's like, how do you know all that stuff? And I was like, well, I've got promos and at the record store I work at, which is Volt. He's like, you work at Volt? You know, just like incredulous.
Yeah.
and there's a part of me, this goes back to like, I think anyone who's like young and insecure is like, yeah, I probably don't know enough about music to deserve that job. Like, this job should go to someone who knows more about music and bands and music history and, like, you know, 77 and the birth of punk or whatever and all that kind of stuff. And actually what it did is, like, it really, like, forced me to, I viewed it as like an education at times, where I was like, no, I'm going to listen to stuff even if I hate it. And I'm going to dig through all these UCDs and put them on, if nothing else, but then to say I've heard them, you know?
Yeah.
Because I felt like I had to do it as like a right, or because I got the job and now I have to backfill, you know, my music education. How did you feel about that?
No, absolutely. I think for me, and I think I still have the same problem now, professionally as a computer programmer, where you just kind of accept things the way they are and don't have like a real drive to understand why they are the way they are, until the situation necessitates it. So, because I feel like for me, I just would much rather enjoy the moment rather than think too much about like what it all means or what led up to that moment that I'm enjoying it. You know what I mean? And that's why Dennis probably was a history major and I was a communications major. Right. But I think that, yeah, like, but at one point you realize that all of the things that you're listening to are, you're listening to them because somebody else made something before that influenced them. And that piques your curiosity. And so then you go down this rabbit hole back to the Clash, or you go back down this rabbit hole to the Jam, or to like Elvis Costello and like just like the British pop and you know, whatever, like, you know, German prog or whatever, like whatever rabbit hole you're in at the time. And I think I feel the same way. Like I think I had an imposter syndrome immediately. Like,
what if someone asked me something and I don't know the answer, yeah. The customer.
Yeah. So then I think, it was like around that time, like it was just like maybe whenever I could pick up like a big takeover magazine or just, you know, mm-hmm. And that was around that time I started like understanding how to use the internet more effectively and, reading about who is in
for
this,
good.
Like, right. for not for evil.
Exactly.
And just like go to these bands' websites and read, like, you know, they have like, blog entries, or if they have like a Blogspot, which was a thing at the time, and there's another or MySpace or whatever around that time, and like you'd see like their, if they had a music page, like listed their influences and just kind of like read up about that. But that's kind of stretching through that whole time. It doesn't, you know, it's not like I hit the ground running.
Well, it's really daunting. Like, honestly, I mentioned the guy who, and I forget his name, and I apologize, as I should know because I worked with him a bunch, but the guy who knew all this stuff about indie rap. And it's like, you know, I enjoyed some hip hop, but it was like I dismissed most of it because I was like, well, it doesn't really speak to me. And I don't know, like, the kids at school like it, so that means I have to hate it or something like that, you know, whatever I came up with. And then, like, he's like, well, actually, there's guys who probably have punk or hardcore roots or have indie roots, and they just choose to express themselves musically in this way, but it's still a DIY ethic, and it's still, they're playing basement shows. They're just doing it with an MC behind them. And it's just all this stuff where it's like, oh my gosh, like, that's a lot of work, because I need to figure out all about this stuff and all these labels. And then you realize, you just go section by section from the storage, right? It's like the store. It's like, well, what do I know about jazz? Nothing. What do I know I don't like about jazz? I don't like elevator music, but man, all this stuff from the 20s to basically anything up to like a fusion era is like really, really good. How do I begin to like learn about that? And then like the moment you feel like you realize there's like a Revelation catalog, you're like, I actually have to now go back to Revelation 1 and listen to all these things.
Right.
And then it's like, that's not even counting like Sub Pop and Merge and Matador and like all of these things that you're like, you just sit there and you meet these people when you're younger that can rattle off this stuff. And you're like, how do you know all that? Like, do you not go to school? Like, how do you know all this stuff about music? And then you end up just like immersing yourself in it and driving to and from work. And it's just like, it happens organically. It's really strange.
It's like it's your second job, you know. It's it becomes something that's just like what you think about. And really, it's really because of those people that you hang around with. It's that's their world, and whenever you move into someone else's world, it becomes yours.
Yeah, I think there's an element of fear of, it was like peer pressure in a positive sense of making you not accept stuff at face value, dig below the surface, find what's underneath.
On the other hand,
there's a negative side of it.
On the other hand, then you realize, like, you know, 5-8 years later, that it's not as big a deal as you thought it was. And you just like, you kind of have to pick your own, like, you can't just like, you can't worry so much about, like, if you don't like quote unquote get this, like, that it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you qualify as a pariah necessarily.
Yeah, no, totally. But like, it takes a while to get there. I mean, I remember distinctly at the peak, I probably had, just thousands of CDs.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I would actually go into a record store. This is after I left Volt when I was here. I would actually go into a record store and I'd buy one CD or LP that I wanted. And then I'd buy one that I felt I had to buy. Like, that makes sense. Like, I bought one for me and then one for the shelf. because I literally had this thought in my head where I need to buy this Upsetters record or something. Because if someone ever comes and gets to you, because they were in alphabetical order, they would see it and they would know that I was cool.
Right.
And of course, that literally, I don't think ever happened in my life where anyone ever went into my bedroom and made it from A to Z and was like, oh, that's a nice selection there in the use in the U, in the U right. portion of the.
Right. Because if anyone ever did, they would get to W and be like, oh, Weezer, I like that.
Oh, Weezer. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you own Maladroit, non-ironically. Okay. But the thought that I had, that was at the time, it was genuine. It was like, I need to own this because I have to own it. I don't even really want it. I don't want to listen to it, but I need to own it because if you like music, you have to have it on your shelf or something like mm-hmm. that. And that's the negative side of it. But at the same time, like I look back and I wouldn't change any of it. It forced upon me, I think, listening to certain things and expanding my horizons. But it's definitely can be daunting and exhausting, I guess, is another word for it.
Right. And it never ends. Like now, like, you know, I just, you start getting into your own life and like raising a family and providing for family. And then you realize that you've missed out on 10 years of like whatever thing, you know, like obscure band from the 70s has been unearthed since the last time you cracked open, you know, whatever music blog. And then also all the other bands that have come out since then. It's a never ending, you know, it's a never ending stream of new and old.
Wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do think like there's some point, I think if I had to put a date on it, you know, it'd probably be 10 years ago where I just stopped trying. And then you become like some of the people that used to come into Volt, where basically their musical taste was trapped in time. And they did that for a reason, because no new music can be created if you stop checking for new music after a certain date. It's like, it gives you like this control where if I stop caring after 1999 or whatever, pick a date, at least I can go back. And there's not going to be any more that can be created. If I just put a pin in it right there, I can do all the work I want. And I can say that everything from that point and before was the better music. And I don't ever have to be, you know, in the process of catching up with what's new, because I basically put a pin in time and I can only focus on what's behind. Mm. And you would see that with people that would come into Volt and stuff. But I feel like I'm, you know, there now, but not because I wanted to, but because life, you know, forces you to.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's go back to, so we both get a job there. Gene's the manager. He's the owner. He started it. All credit goes to Gene. Like in that town, there was a really, really famous record store called Trash American Style, which is pretty well known throughout the country actually. And Malcolm Tent is still like on Facebook doing, you know, live video sessions and still playing music. And he was great. And talk about someone that forgot more music than you'll ever know.
Yes.
But he was super approachable and was great. And there was Jerosa Records, I think.
Jerosa still there.
Oh, really?
Still holding down the fort. They're in Brookfield, maybe? No.
Yeah. Let's say Brookfield, New Fairfield or something like that.
Yeah. Up there. Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there was anything else. Those are kind of the big three. It was like Volt, Trash, and Jerosa, I want to say, in that little, you know, kind of tri-town area. And, you know, Trash had a lot more, I think, depth. Like they were like a mile deep and an inch wide, I would say. And we were like a mile wide and an inch deep when it came to like our selection. But we would... Sometimes I would just leave Volt and go to Trash and buy stuff there. I think you would do it.
Yeah. Eventually, once you like kind of had the courage to go into Trash and like realize that it's not like
that was daunting the first time for sure.
It was like the same. It was like the same sort of feeling going to Volt for the first time. You know, like because like Trash is very much. It was like it had like it was like music store or the thrift store feel, right? Because there was like clothes and art.
There was a mythology even then around it.
Yeah. And of course there was just like this like deep rivalry between Gene and Malcolm. like just like littered with drama and like failed partnerships and just all kinds of, you know, exaggerated, you know, stories of intrigue and commercial espionage, you know, espionage situations.
Well, like it was the type of thing where it's a small town. There's like 100,000 people in Danbury, and you have these two independent record stores. Probably the town didn't deserve both, and yet they were both there. And one Trash had a cult following and still does, and had a manager who lived and breathed music to a degree, like we said, like very few do. Gene loved music, but there was also an element of like, this is also a business.
Right.
And Malcolm, you know, if he lost money every day, he would somehow still find a way to keep the doors open. But Gene had a business to run and had to make money. And so I think he would approach things a little bit differently. So let's talk about, you know, the experience behind the counter real quick. You know, how did you navigate going from intimidated at Volt to then feeling like you had an air of superiority to those that walked in? And then how did that bubble burst?
So, I remember the first time I think I actually connected with somebody at Volt before I worked there is in the negative. And I remember like I think I went to Salvation Army and I found like a kind of, it was a pretty cool, like there's a picture of me on the Closet Turkey website wearing this t-shirt, I think just like a green, white and brown striped, like, shirt.
I remember it.
Yeah. It's a good shirt. and then I had like my like curly baseball cap. And I was feeling pretty good about myself.
big Tom DeLonge.
That's right, yeah. Big Tom DeLonge fan. Big Blink-182 fan. So I go in there, and I don't know, I don't remember what I was buying, but I don't remember so when Weezer was making their, like, comeback with the Green Album, one of their t-shirts that they issued was, like, the sort of, like, female superhero cartoon.
Yep. You know, I just love that poster.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome poster / t-shirt / art or whatever. And I was like, hey, that's a nice shirt. And he was just like, uh-huh. And I realized at that time, like, that I was it, like, I felt in the moment just from that, just like that, you know, like
I can't be bothered.
Kind of, but also just like you're one guy out of 1,000 that has said that to me today. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, you know, like the way it made me feel, I don't really put too much stock into it, but I think there was probably a point at that moment where I stopped sort of like trying too hard. And you always, like, you know, throughout all of your 20s, you will always try kind of socially to impress people with what you're wearing or whatever. But I think that there was just like a moment where it was like, I need to like reconsider like what I like, you know, maybe I don't need to put the baseball cap on backwards, or maybe I don't need one at all. Like, I'm just overthinking all this. It's just, I remember kind of like processing that. And then when you got the job there and I worked there, I think it was kind of, I think I'd already kind of, sort of assembled this sort of like discretion about me where I didn't try, where I didn't reveal that I was trying so hard. You know what I mean? Like,
But you were.
I mean, right.
We all were, kind of. Yeah. But yeah.
I think I remember this one. Like, there were a few times, because when you work at like an independent mom and pop store of any kind, there's always somebody who's going to come in expecting like the Kmart treatment, or yeah, like big box store treatment, where they're like, this flyer that you sent out, like this flyer arrived late and had a coupon that expired yesterday.
Oh, right. We're like, so what?
Like, yeah, like, or the guy who came in one time, like really wanting to special, because we would do special orders, right? And you could pay for your thing in advance. and get a voucher printed out on Dot Matrix.
And then we'd have to call them. Yeah. Hey, Jim, your Pink Floyd box set arrived. It's here at the counter whenever you're ready.
And he really wanted the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 soundtrack. And this is like...
I love this guy.
This is like, were you there? I don't know, remember if you were there, but it was like 2003 maybe. No one makes it anymore. And you can get it. I mean, you can get it now. But I remember looking it up. I was like, okay, I'll look it up. And so I type it into the computer. And by the way, like, this ancient computer system was already ancient then. You're talking green letters, black background, you know, 12 by 12 screen. I was like, yeah, I see it in the listing, but the thing about this particular distributor is that it's not likely that we're going to get it. So, because if you put through a special order, like, they would put down a deposit towards it, but they wouldn't, when they picked up, they wouldn't pay for the whole thing until they paid for the rest of the CD. So
yeah, Gene wasn't going to mess around. He needs that $5 deposit to put it.
He really did the CD order. He really did. These are razor thin margins.
I know your word is good, sir, but I'm going to need that $5.
I'm going to need that. I don't think that we're going to be able to get it. And he looked at me and he said, because he looked around kind of thinking like he knows like what my motives are, that I'm just like, oh, Ninja Turtles 2 soundtrack, faux pas, like, how dare you even come in here suggesting such trash? But really, I was just like really legitimately saying, like, I literally can't get that. So he looks at me and says, you wouldn't be lying to me, would you? Like, in that same tone. And I remember at the time, I think it was Brian. Brian.
Crust Punk Brian?
Crust Punk Brian, yeah. Ska, super into ska.
Yeah, Crest he loved, he's a big Hot Water Music guy. Anything with a gravelly voice, he loved.
That's true, yeah. I remember him getting angry, the me, poor like, guy. Yeah. Yeah, against me, that's right. That was kind of the experience almost every day. Something like that would happen.
He thought you were being an elitist, but you actually weren't.
Right. Right. So I think the flip side of that is, like, even though I knew I did feel like an air of superiority, sadly, about other people, that I was often more judged for being that way just because of where I worked, which is interesting.
Yeah. From our group of friends, which I thought was a pretty cool group of friends, they had diverse personalities. They were pretty funny. I think they all were like, just surprised. I think because we were relatively mild mannered back then. And it's just like, oh, I can't believe you guys got a job there. And so we're like, huh. All right, yeah. I guess we're in now, whatever that in means. But I do remember when I would work there, I mean, I took such great offense. Like, this is the time when, like, every band matters and every band saved your life that you're listening to, quote unquote. And I'm putting that, like, you know, oh, it's this band saved my life or whatever. And so when someone doesn't like it, you just are like, I can't believe this. Like, what kind of taste do you have? And I remember specifically, I think you might have been working there that day. It's like, two guys and a girl come in and they're, you know, it's not our cup of tea. And so they're looking in, they're like, hey, would you guys have Dispatch? Just like, you know, it's like someone who thinks that Dave Matthews Band is like a little too hip. And so they're looking for Dispatch. Sure. It's like the guys, you know, Hacky Sack in the parking lot and that kind of thing. Uh-huh. It's what is what it is. But it's like, we weren't into it. I wasn't into it at the time. And actually, remember, I had, the first Some Girls single, which is called The Rains, on. Mm-hmm. They had burned it on their CD and was playing it. And usually Gene was like, if we can't sell it, you can't play it. But when he wasn't there, you know, we would play what we want.
Right.
And it's pretty loud and short and upgrading. And they started laughing at it. Like, they're like, what is this? Like,
I was there that day.
They're looking for this. They're looking for dispatch. And I'm like, okay. And I don't know if I've ever been this mad about anything before in my life and since, actually. But like, in their general direction, when they were laughing, I just spit it.
No, you took a gulp of water from a water bottle.
Just spit water in their direction. And I was just so disgusted. It's like, how can you, buying this, make fun of the band that I love, you know, or something like that? And I don't even know if they saw me do it or whatever, but they ended up leaving shortly after. I just, the visceral reaction that I had mm-hmm. towards it was pretty like, it might have like caused me to like never want to do that again, but I was just so mad. It was just like someone like slapped a member of my family or something. You take things so personal, and things mean so much to you back then.
Yeah.
You do go overboard. I love the store itself doesn't exist anymore. It's gone.
It's a Cold Stone Creamery.
I wonder if that's even still around. I mean, when's the last time you even drove past it, you think?
It's been 3 years or so now. I only live about an hour from there now. But yeah.
I live a little bit further.
Is that 30 hours?
30 hours.
24 hour drive.
Yeah. But what are some other funny stories? A couple funny stories I have that I remember. When another buddy of ours, John, who worked there, Pro V, we would put on music and stage dive off the counter. Mm-hmm. We would take turns doing that. I remember Jamie from Hatebreed would come before they were really popular, and he would have a distro for his label called Stillborn Records. And he'd mm-hmm. come by every 6 months and say, can you stock this band and that band? And he was someone cool to talk to, and you would see all these cool people and that's what really I think was the lasting impression. At the same time, we were finding underground music mm-hmm. and DIY music and subculture music and going to shows. The same people that you could buy a CD from would then come into the record store and just talk to you.
Yeah.
And it could have been like Pat from Fast Break, or I remember Rich from like The Dedication, or Josh from AN and then Head Automatica and stuff, and then Jamie. It was just awesome. And it's just like, I can't believe that the people I was listening to in the car are this nice and cordial and normal people. Mm-hmm. And that's what ingrained in me is like, I'm like a part of something working here, as small as it is. And I was super proud of that in a weird way too.
Absolutely. And it's kind of your window into like, I guess like there's like the wider commercial industry, because Volt was very much like under the thumb of like the big like distributors and big PR agencies for trying to sell like the latest Jay-Z or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, whatever big, you know, flavor of the month on Geffen, or just giant, like just like these really big acts too.
Mm-hmm.
Who are all like, you know, varying degrees of like quality or not quality, whatever, it's like a one hit wonder or just like a stalwart of the industry or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then these smaller labels that just like they are more human, and they're people who are doing something they're passionate about. And that was probably my first window into that side of like a business. It became more than just like a hobby at that point. Then it becomes like a profession. Like maybe I could get into that business,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I'll go back to that, but like the reality of that business model at Volt was, and this is funny, like, you know, the way that CDs were back then used to be released on Tuesday. I guess now they're released on Fridays, but Tuesday, but the shipment would come in sometimes on Friday, and the record store wasn't supposed to put them out on the shelves until Tuesday. That way the rollout was the same everywhere. Well, Gene was smart in that he would sell them early. And so everyone in town knew, and it was mostly hip hop releases. I mean, sometimes it was, if there was a Slipknot album or some like, you know, big hard rock album, same thing, but
Insane Clown Posse.
ICP. If it was never really, you just had to know that Volt would, maybe have the record early, and people would call in on Friday. So let's say the new Jay-Z album came out. They'd call in on Friday and say, "Hey, do you guys have a new Jay-Z album?" And the code was, "You can come down and check it out." Mm-hmm. And that was the code to let them know that it was here. Because if you said it was there and it was a label rep, you get busted. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you lose a lot of, you know, end displays and, you know, promos that they would do and the store would get money from. So they'd come in and they'd say, "Do you have the new Jay-Z?" You'd have to open it at the counter. Take off the bar. Take off the whole stuff.
There's a generic SKU.
Generic SKU. And then you would sell it at $18.99 or Gene would, I mean, obviously he's smart. It's like the demand was there. So he would jack up the price those over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you would even have a CD like $20, $19.99. I remember that when 50 Cent had that first new album, it was like $19.99 we were selling it for. And then on Tuesday, Gene would go X out the generic SKUs and input by hand all as if he sold them all that day on Tuesday, the release day. And so the point of that story was all the Jay-Z albums we sold early and that kind of stuff allowed us to have these other, all the other things that we had there. It's kind of like an actor who does a Hollywood blockbuster so he can make 5 art films afterwards. Like, I'm going to get paid here, but it allows me to do all this other stuff. And so that's where the business model was different than Trash, where Gene's like, I need to do this to keep the lights on, but I'm also going to try to, you know, propagate, you know, subculture and different genres, even though that's not where the money is.
Yeah. Yep.
And so we'll probably wrap it up here soon, but to get to the actual record label part, right? So me and you were both working there and Emily was working there. Emily is awesome. She's still, I think, in the Northeast area. Great taste in music. I learned a lot about bands from her and stuff. And she used to have a boyfriend that would come in named Scott, and Scott would just come in and hang out. And like a lot of us had nothing to do, nowhere to go. He was a goofball. He was super funny. We would actually put on movies sometimes and just watch him on the floor, just sit there on the floor and watch a movie. And then if someone wanted to buy something, we'd get up, you know, ring him up and then go back to the floor and watch a movie. And one day after I had left to move to Austin, he walks in to Volt, right, or something like that, and says like, "Oh, I have a solo project I'm doing. Like, here's a song or something." Just get us to that point with how that first happened, and that'll be episode 2, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Like, I don't remember exactly how it happened, but after you moved to Austin, I stayed at Volt for maybe like a year and a half, 2 years until it closed down, and my family had moved from Danbury to the next one of the other next towns over, Bethel, Connecticut. And I was working on a project that was like just like an electronic music project that never really went anywhere.
Leather tie now.
That's the one. Thanks for mentioning it.
It's got a cult following.
It says, it's on SoundCloud if you want to hear it. I saw him in the local coffee shop. I think it was Molten Java. Molten Java was the place. It was a, you know, local mom pop coffee shop where anybody who didn't have anything better to do could be found.
It couldn't be troubled to go to Starbucks in Danbury.
Right. Between the hours of 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. So I was there on my old compact with a Q laptop on Fruity Loops making tracks. And so Scott walks in and I think
creating jam after jam.
Yeah. I think I can't remember if I had heard some of his stuff at that time. I think I maybe I saw him play at, a place called bar in New Haven, maybe. It was the establishment was a bar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Paint the picture.
They also served excellent pizza. So he played there one night, and I think, like, you know, Scott has this just like this ability to channel like the softer Big Star songs / Elliott Smith and just like the Zombies and just sort of Baroque pop and folk music in this way that some people, like, they might say, you know, they might say it's derivative, but to us, I think it, like, really, he has his own unique style and ability to write pop songs that few people have. Just,
yeah, the best type where it can get lodged in your brain with really depressive lyrics, where it's lovelorn lyrics, and yet it's got a finger picking part or a chorus or a melody. Mm-hmm. It's like the best of the Beatles songs, where it's like, depending on your mood, I can either be uplifted or, you know, wallow. And
really good.
The song can do either or. It's great.
Yeah. So I think at one point I talked to him and said, I think at that point I had talked to another guy who worked at Volt, maybe right after your time, Rob May. And
him and Britt started after me, I think.
Yep. Him and Britt. It was Rob's idea for the name Closet Trekkie Records. And, he and I were both sort of these just like, hopeless nerdy guys who really like science fiction, but also sort of came into this like sort of very different, music scene with a bunch of people who really liked, you know, like just, you know, very, 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 like a lot of posturing and, like being fashionable and cool. And that's really different for where, like, my personal background, like being the son of a computer nerd. And, so we both had this sort of idea, like, that we were both a little bit, you know, nerdy and geeky before that was cool. His idea was that if he ever started a label, he would call it Closet Trekkie. So he and I were like the first partners in that.
Did the label idea start with Scott or at before you
it was before
identified
that.
An artist?
It was before that. And around the same time, we did like a CDR for Screamo Band from the east side of New York State, around the area of Pauling or Patterson area, called Henry Spencer.
What was his name? Yeah, what was the blonde kid's name?
I don't remember his name. So sad.
He was a nice kid.
But
he used to come in a bowl all the time.
Yeah, good kid. Cool guy.
Yeah.
But Mark, it was Mark. Mark was the one you were talking about. Mark Ripalone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Super nice.
Super, super good guys. So we like put out their CDR, and like I went to a bunch of their shows and like manned their merch table and stuff like that a couple times, maybe only once, I don't remember. But so we had that on there, and then we had and then I really wanted to get into vinyl records and have those pressed. So our first 7-inch I was talking to Scott at Bolton Job. I said, hey, can I put out, like, would it be cool if we put out one of your, like, just like a 7-inch AB? And he said, yeah, I have a couple of new songs that I've recorded. And that was Alice and what was the B-side?
Loser in Love.
Loser in Love. That's right. So I got like a bunch of construction paper and printed them on my inkjet at home. And got some 7-inch plastic sleeves. Ordered a run of, did we make 50 or 100 or something? 7 inches.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you basically call. This is basically, I think, winter of 2005. Because I remember in January of 06, I was actually visiting back again in your room in Bethel, and we were stamping stuff.
Oh, okay. Right.
It was like January of 06.
Yeah.
That we were like, you want to help me stamp some of these? But before that, you had mentioned, you're like, I'm going to do this thing. And I was like, can I be a part of it? Whatever that looks like. And I thought we did like 100.
Yeah.
Because the price break, basically, it was almost the same amount of money.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
And you got the awesome two stamps, one with the iconic logo, mm-hmm. which you designed, I guess.
Yes, the ray gun logo with what's the name of the font? Cooper Black, I think. CTR.
Yeah. And then the other side was an arms and legs mm-hmm. Stamp.
Also a pre-made font. Just handwriting-ish font.
Yeah. Looks like the Joker. Looks like Joker font, actually, yeah, from Microsoft Word.
Yeah, something like that.
And who did the kid walking? Do you remember? Was that Jay or was that Scott just gave that to you?
Scott took a picture of a silhouette like that in a New York City subway mural on his flip phone, texted it to me. and I think I pulled that into Illustrator and I traced it and I put it on there. And that was
good. That was I actually have a t-shirt of that.
There's a t-shirt of that?
I still have a t-shirt. Yeah, it's a great t-shirt. Just says arms and legs with that font and then the picture of the kid walking. I don't know how I got it, but Scott sent it to me like a long time ago.
Wow.
But yeah, I remember you saying, I'm doing this thing. Do you want to be a part of it? I'm like, yeah, I'll do whatever. Even if it's just giving you money to offset some of the costs. I just want to like be a part of this. It just felt like the first time, like you had found something where we could actually not just be at the cash register, but putting something out into the world where it wouldn't have existed before. And it was like super exciting to think about it. And then I actually heard the songs and I was just blown away. I mean, I'm still blown away by those songs. And anyone I've ever played them to, no matter their taste, identify like Scott as like, this guy has got like whatever talent is, like he has it. It's awesome. And those are super simple songs and, you know, bedroom recordings. And yet when the talent's there, it's just like, it's there. Like
yeah.
You can tell, it doesn't matter. And, I remember it's being so proud of that when the construction paper, I think we had green and then some of them were red construction paper covers. I think I have both mm-hmm. and a test press. I still have that. And just having them, I think I took probably 10 back with me to Texas and handed them out to people. And I was like, this is a new thing. I was just like, so proud of it. This is a thing me and my friend are trying to do. And at that point, basically, Rob just dropped out, right? I mean, I never even talked to Rob, so it was
yeah, like I don't remember. I don't think we ever talked about anybody dropping out, but I think we just got busy, you know. And I think he and I like went in half seas on like a microphone because we kind of wanted to get into recording too. But nothing ever really, we never. And I think we parted on amicable terms. The last time I saw him, I think, was in Williamsburg, randomly on a street corner outside of a bodega. Nice. Good guy. He's really super cool. Spent a lot of time.
He always seemed nice. And he had that Bear Trap EP was good that he put out. I remember I heard that.
Yeah, he had Tractor Flip?
The rock and roll one?
Tractor Flip.
Yeah, Tractor Flip or something like that, yeah.
They were awesome. They were such a good band.
Yeah, he was super talented too.
Yeah, when I was I was in a band called Longshanks with some friends of mine, and we did a show together at a bar in Bushwick called Goodbye Blue Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they were.
I remember the video of that. Well, like, so that's the first. That was CTR1 officially. That mm-hmm. Alice and Loser in Love. 7-inch. And then, you know, maybe the next couple episodes we'll talk about just the rigmarole of turning that into a more going concern and how basically it's just an excuse to throw money down the drain, but somehow it's still fulfilling but also exhausting. Mm-hmm. And then you know, maybe we can get, I'd love to get Scott on. Maybe he can talk about those days and see what he's up to, and go through the roster, and who knows what else.
Yeah, no, this has been good. It's now it's in the history books, right?
It's out there.
We've released it into the eternal stream.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
All right.